Support for the Media Project comes from the College of St. Rose, Albany, New York, offering a new Bachelor of Science degree in public health with a focus on social, physical, and behavioral sciences. strose.edu. From Northeast Public Radio, this is the Media Project, a weekly discussion about issues confronting the media.
Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. They know the lowdown, now it can be told. I'll tell you quite reliably off the record about some charming people I have known.
Time again for the Media Project. No, I'm not Rex Smith. He's away this week. This is Judy Patrick, editor of the Daily Gazette. Joining us this week is WAMC's Alan Shartok.
Hello. You have a devilish look in your face, which I have never seen before, because now you have this real power to wrangle us.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And also with us today is Stu Shinsky, executive editor of the Poughkeepsie Journal. Welcome, Stu.
Pleasure to be here. Great to see you, Judy and Alan.
Yeah, it's a different kind of panel. We'll see how things go.
Yeah. Now, you guys are usually competitors, aren't you? I mean, you, when the great contests come up, then you see that in the same sort of class, the Times Union, the Poughkeepsie Journal, you know, the Schenectady Gazette, is the Independent Gazette, as I should
say. Daily Gazette.
The Independent Daily Gazette.
Exactly. We're all competitors.
Yes, we are. We compete for readers, most of all, however.
You know, we compete with that darn WAMC, too.
Well, that's the great thing. You think about this. In the old days, there was a sort of contemptuousness between newspapers and radio. Now, there's a mutual benefit. We all get along together, and you participate, and we love the fact that you guys are here because you help us. Now, what exactly do you get out of it?
Yeah, we get things out of it, too. I think all media is interacting more. We have a partnership with a local television station.
You do? You're off our list.
We share tips.
I always get lots of feedback when I appear, always. Sometimes I'll hear it before I literally leave the parking lot. On my way home, I'll get a phone call or a text or something. Hey, just heard you on WAMC on the roundtable. And then Sunday night, I'll always get a few messages as well after the Media Project
ends. Isn't that interesting? Because, you know, we have a little problem in our parking lot here on Central Avenue in beautiful downtown Albany, in that people have been relieving themselves in our parking lot. So I had to come up with a plan to put a stop to it. So I put a gigantic speaker in the...
What show did you broadcast into the parking lot, Mr. Chardock?
And people will hear Alan say, what are you doing?
That's right. What? Hey, you, get out of there.
Because if you're putting Media Project in the parking lot and it's scaring people away, it might not be good.
So let's talk a little bit about some media issues here. This is a big political story, but it's also a really important media story. Donald Trump decided this week to make Stephen Bannon, chairman of the Breitbart News website, his campaign's chief executive. It's kind of a merging of the ultra-conservative media, and this follows his news that Roger Ailes is also going to be a close advisor to the Trump campaign. So what does this say about the state of the news media? Is this good for media going forward?
You know, the one thing I didn't see was, did he actually leave Breitbart?
He's on leave.
He's on leave.
And he is working unpaid for Trump.
And then he's going to go back to Breitbart.
Apparently. And there's also news, the New York Times is reporting that Donald Trump and his son-in-law are actively looking to buy some sort of media site. So the merging of politics and media, which is nothing new, but this takes it to a new level. What do you think, Alan?
Here's what I think. I've always suspected that much of the media, not all of it, but much of the media is in one camp or another. Also, that attaches to the brain of the publisher or of the editor. So I'm pretty sure that the New York Times can be generally seen as a vote for the Democrats. I know that the New York Post is almost always part and parcel, a part of the Republican apparatus, and is owned by Rupert Murdoch, of course. The Daily News is owned by a guy by the name of Zuckerman, who is a, you know, Democrat, obviously, or is a liberal, obviously. And so there's always been a sort of a denial on the part of the press that we're partisan. But I've always thought and said so here, to the great consternation of you guys and Rex and everybody else, that that's the way you are. Don't you see?
I definitely see. And I think in this case, Breitbart has been pretty definitive in its stances on issues. And quite frankly, they've been quite aligned with Mr. Trump's issues. So do most people care outside of the world of journalism? I'm going to say no, they don't.
No, but Stu, there's a difference, and I think you know it, and I think your diagnostic question was excellent. Is he going back? He's on paid leave. Is he going back? So this is a little further than we usually see, that somebody takes leave
as
chief executive, goes over to run the campaign, and then comes back. Now the line is getting even more definitive, so that this is the way that some journalists are.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that melding of media and politics erodes public confidence in the media as an objective observer. And this is so obvious. People go, of course, this is how it works. But really, this isn't how it's supposed to work.
Well, who wrote the supposed to manual? You know, I don't see that, Judy. I mean, I know you're provocative on this, and that's the way you always are. But I think that's not right. Look, people hate the press. We know that. All the survey research shows it. And this, as you say, will only make it worse.
And in terms of coverage of the Trump campaign going forward, does this mean the mainstream media is not going to have any access to Trump? Is this all going to be, anything he says is going to be on Fox News and Rush Limbaugh?
Yeah, I think there'll be plenty of mainstream media access. I think what Trump may be looking for here is some media expertise, because it could be considered that he's fouled it up considerably, as has Hillary, on numerous levels here. But I do wonder, will Breitbart become, even from the people within that wing of the party that really goes to Breitbart as a go-to, will they consider that this is only now a Trump thing, or are they going to get more of what they've been getting, and that's okay with them?
Well, I don't know. You know, if the Daily News and Zuckerman puts a picture of Trump on the wood, as we say, the front page, mm-hmm. in clown's uniform over and over again, where exactly is the step from telling him and even editorializing and say, listen, Hillary, this is what you have to do. Don't you think that the die is cast? We're all in on the game. It's just this one little step has really caused consternation for people like you and Judy, with your goody-two-shoes, you know, attitude about the way things should be in the press.
Well, I mean, I've said before, and, you know, we've talked about before, the Daily News, and I think it was mentioned last week, actually, on the show, that the Daily News and the New York Post are sort of separate. No one does what they do as well as they do it. So if the Daily News puts Trump on the front page in a clown uniform, they know exactly what they're doing. They're trying to sell their papers.
Sure.
You know, you're not going to do that in your paper. I'm not going to do it on my website, vice versa. That's what they do.
Except,
here, but,
Stu, if I may just interrupt for a second, don't you think, though, that this is 7 million copies, I think, of each of these, or there used to be?
That's probably not even that much anymore.
But that's a lot of people,
point. It's probably a few hundred thousand each.
So when you say, well, those people are different, yeah, but they're big.
They're big, but they know what they're getting. And just like Breitbart gives its viewers and readers that viewpoint from that wing of the Republican Party. That's what the Daily News does. That's what the Post does. That's what Fox does. So they're all filling that little niche because they're, frankly, they know their audience.
Well, I want to go to Ailes for one moment. The scuttlebutt is that it's Murdoch's kids who objected to Ailes, and that's sort of why he was out. And now, in order to keep them close, isn't there an old thing about keep your enemies close?
Hold your friends close and your enemies closer.
Right.
So I promise we won't only talk about Trump today, but I did want to hit upon this notion of, is it fair for the media and for psychiatrists to talk about, to analyze Donald Trump or any candidate from afar? We've been doing this for about 20 years, but this year especially, you're seeing a lot of this.
Well, I don't think so. I mean, I don't mind if somebody who doesn't know better, you know, isn't a psychiatrist or professional, calls him a psychopath or calls him a sociopath or does all of those names to him. But I don't like it when professionals who should know better use those terms. And they're very angry when you call them on it. So, you know, say, well, we're professionals and we can see from off on the side what's going on. I don't like it one bit. And I think newspapers ought to be, and the media ought to be careful when they allow this to happen.
You know, for the pros who have the PhDs, and I'm certainly not a doctor or anything close.
But you're smart.
Well, I try. How does a PhD psychologist or psychiatrist make that diagnosis without an in-person examination? I mean, we go to the supermarket. We'll think about the cashier. We'll think about the person next to us at the traffic light in the next car. We'll do our own little analysis. But we're not basing a presidential candidate's worth on it. And if you have a PhD and this is what you do, I don't get how you responsibly do that without talking to the guy in person.
Right, and the profession does have ethics that say they should not be doing this. Right. But this was an unusual case where 100 or so got together and issued a statement saying that they were concerned. I mean, in the past, reporters will try to bait a psychiatrist and say, well, what do you think? And in that respect, the media is partially to blame. But in this case, this was apparently initiated by the profession.
It went back to the Goldwater, I think in the 60s, where during the race against LBJ, I believe, a bunch of psychiatrists, I believe, basically issued this statement about LBJ. And then I think the National Psychiatrist Association or whatever the professional association that says, you can't do that. That's unethical. You never met the guy. You never did a full clinical breakdown on him.
Okay, on the other hand. Let's try the other hand. I've given you my why this is dangerous view. And I think it hurts the profession, to be honest with you, that they're just spewing around these terms. But, you know, Hitler in the 1930s was coming up, and a lot of people thought he was a clown, and a lot of people didn't say an awful lot. There may be a moral imperative on the part of people who are hearing what they consider to be fascist language from Trump to be able to say, in this circumstance, it's important for us to label him. Now, as you have already heard, I don't agree with that. But it may be that there are times in your life you have to go for it.
Interesting. So NPR has decided it is going to eliminate the comments on its website. They say that this is partially because it costs money to do this. It's
That's
expensive.
Not what they're doing.
But they're also shit. Well, so what are they doing, Alan?
Well, I suspect, although I'm not inside their minds, once again, although I'm not a psychiatrist, I suspect what's happening.
Well, you have a doctorate, so you're ahead of us.
He can analyze us, too.
I suspect that what's going on here is that they have the same problem we all have. Everybody has it, which are persistent trolls who don't know where the line should be. And they come on each and every day, and they say, you know, millions of listeners, and maybe you get 15 or 20 of these guys, and they come on each day and they say the most outrageous things. And there's a point at which you say, I don't want to take this anymore. I don't think it's worth it. I think we're giving these people a shouting position which they don't deserve, and we're going to just put a stop to it. Now, many of us have changed the rules. We have moderators who look at every one of these and say, no, this is unacceptable. But then, you know, that takes precious resources, too.
You know, I think it's certainly that. And I believe this story from the Washington Post had mentioned that it's 0.06% of all the users of the site are those who are actually commenting. Out of 33 million, it's only several thousand users who are commenting. I think it's even simpler than that. I just think it's technology outstripping tradition, because social media came along after websites had commenting ability, and it's all moved onto social media.
So now you can Facebook anybody.
So the NPR-branded Facebook site is going to become that discussion area instead of doing it on the actual NPR website for that story. At PoughkeepsieJournal.com, we used to get an incredible volume of comments on our story. We get some now, but there's a bazillion of those comments on our Facebook posts.
Oh, no,
that's where the discussion is.
No, that's fascinating.
Yeah.
That's
it just moved. The comments moved from here to there as technology advanced.
Well, that's a good point.
You know, and the downside to that is you're losing that engagement on your website. You're getting the engagement on Facebook, but on your website, you get those important page views. We're also seeing the move to social media, and it's easier to deal with it then. You don't have to have someone comment, you know, moderate it often. But engagement is the name of the game now in our business. We want to engage with our readers, our audience. Alan, you do it when you ask for people to phone in and call in, and we're trying to find new ways to do it. But these comments on our websites, I agree with NPR. It does, you get the same people again and again and again.
And there's also legal implications, because depending on if you edit some of these comments or change them, you're actually owning the
Good
content,
point.
And then you're legally liable for that content if it's considered slanderous or libelous, which is something I know our company, the Gannett Company that owns the Poughkeepsie Journal, has basically said, look, under the law, and I verified this just 2 weeks ago with our corporate lawyers, a commenter is responsible for what they post. The actual service provider is not legally provided. That doesn't mean we want trash on the website, but there is a responsibility of the poster to be on top of what they do.
Interesting. So let me ask you guys, do you have policies at your newspapers in which columnists are not supposed to, or journalists is not supposed to criticize another journalist on the same paper?
Nothing, not really. But, you know, it's a little bit of bad form to even criticize another columnist of another paper.
Well, how about on your paper? You don't say to your people, that's not a good idea, do you?
No.
I once worked on a newspaper where they, you know, I had deep disagreements with the drama guy and with the music guy. I thought that they were unnecessarily cruel to the people that they were covering. And so I gave them nicknames. For what it was worth, I gave them nicknames when I was writing for another paper. But when I came to the big paper, they said to me, you know, we don't do that here. Okay. And this is why I love your point, Stu. And now I notice that the publisher of the paper, which told me not to do that, leaves a Facebook message on his Facebook site criticizing me for a mistake I made on the radio. Mm-hmm. Now it's getting interesting. Don't you think? Don't you see?
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, Facebook is the old sort of gathering town meeting, you know, the old New England classic town meeting. It's now on Facebook. Facebook is where the world gets together to chat.
But not everybody sees everything, right? I mean, not everybody sees that.
No, there's algorithms that control what pops up on your newsfeed, and Facebook just tweaked them again. But the whole world, because of social media now, everyone has their own megaphone. So if someone wants to call out Dr. Alan Chartok for being a this, that, and the other thing, he's going to do it on Facebook. Because you know what? Sometimes they don't want to face their accuser or the person they're accusing.
So you have algorithms on your paper?
Well, Facebook does. On our website, if people post stuff, they have to meet our terms of service, meaning they cannot post certain things that are, you know, knowingly inaccurate, because we'll take them down. If we see it, we will take it down.
Do you have one person who just covers all of that stuff?
We have a few people who are equipped and have the access to do so.
Uh-huh. Yeah, we don't like personal attacks either. If someone's just making fun of someone, or it's a personal attack, you know. But from the outside looking in, it when you get these online fights between columnists, for example, it can be amusing and fun to watch.
I think so.
And you know, it has gone back. I mean, people, pros and cons, especially if you're talking about an issue. But if you're just nitpicking someone or making fun of someone for making a mistake, media watchers do it all the time. Yeah. You can do it in a column or a blog, but calling them out on Facebook can be, I think, poor form.
Well, you know, in all honesty, that's very kind of you, Judy, but I don't know that he really was doing that. He just saw an opportunity to critique.
Just wanted to be heard. He just wanted to have his little implant on the world, you know, and you were the end of that exploit.
I can take it.
Yeah.
But we all are trying to get our audiences to interact with us more and more, and it's more and more of a challenge, especially getting the non-trolls to participate.
Yeah, the non-trolls.
Yeah, there are a lot of people, they're lurkers, just watch or read, and they don't really step forward, and they just kind of enjoy the show. And we'll see how NPR fares with their switch to Facebook. And again, they were saying it still will save them a little bit of money. Our commenting doesn't cost us any money, aside from the time it takes us to delete comments.
Yeah, same here. It's
well, you know, it's so interesting.
It's built in.
Because I was talking to an editor of an online paper, and he said every day the same guy calls him. The same guy leaves terrible, terrible messages. He says, I don't know whether to let him go or not. Because obviously people, you know, like that stuff.
They like to be heard. They like
not the guy who's posting, but the other people. He doesn't care about that guy. He doesn't like him. But he says, well, people like a little rough and tumble here. And here's this guy, and he has a potty mouth, and he says this stuff over and over again. And I don't know whether to let him on or not.
You know, I often think it's just that small group that sometimes engages in that kind of conversation that most people will tune out after a while. It's fun to begin with, but then after a while, it gets a little monotonous.
And if they get too strident, usually it'll sort of self-police, where others will sort of say, hey, dummy, no, that's wrong. Here's what it really is. And sometimes it'll self-place, but sometimes the trolls will just, frankly, they're relentless.
They're relentless.
They're just absolutely relentless because it's what they're all about.
And I am not a psychiatrist, but they're crazy.
So the state of Illinois has made its freedom of information law stronger, but surprisingly, advocates of freedom of information laws are not really applauding this, in part because I think there's a frustration that the law doesn't always work well. I know, Stu, at your paper, you do a lot of foiling.
We do a ton of use of the FOI law, the Freedom of Information law, which is designed not just for reporters and the media, by the way, folks. It's designed for anybody to get information about how their government operates and what they do. And there are parameters that are excluded from access. But in the Illinois story, it's the same as New York. The law has no teeth. And only those who have the resources to really pursue something are able to stand up to a challenge when information is blocked. Joe Schmo isn't going to hire a lawyer to go get that document if the government says no and they're obstinate about it. The laws have no teeth. So this Illinois thing, it might be stronger, but is it going to really be effective?
No, but it's interesting. It's a point that you have made before and that Rex has made also, in that the Hearst Corporation, which he works for, you work for Gannett, you know, have lawyers.
Yes.
And you can get what you want.
Yes.
But, you know, there are a lot of people who don't even have that resource. Don't even know what telephone number to call.
Yeah.
I would say in my paper, about 80% of our FOILs get rejected now. We have a reporter working on a case where a young man was chased by a police officer in a car, died. We can't even get the accident report, the autopsy report. And it's demoralizing to young reporters who think that they have this law there at their disposal. But often there are excuses. It's under investigation. You cannot release it.
Again, and if you get it, you're going to get it much, much later than when you need it.
And it's going to be redacted.
And redacted.
Quite significantly.
And that is, there are clauses in the law which are designed to let the law and let the situation unfold without, quote-unquote, the interference of transparency. But, yeah, there's certain things that somehow turn out to be, just not available when maybe they should be.
Right. That's not to say the law doesn't serve a good purpose, but, again, it can be frustrating. All right, here's another fun topic.
Oh, good.
Broadcasters, and the headline is, what do you do?
Broadcasters are so much fun, Judy.
What do you do when you get video bombed? I watch this whenever I'm watching live stand-up shots on television of the Today Show, and you get the silly guy in the background
mugging
his, putting rabbit ears behind somebody's head, and so it talks about what standards should be when television stations decide to go live. Often they're just going live for the sake of having a live body on the air.
They go live because they can.
And also because it's a huge payoff. I love the fact that, we all know that, for example, CNN, their numbers go way up when something terrible happens and they put somebody on the street and they're loath to let it go. Mm-hmm. So even the next morning when it's all over and nobody's around and there's traffic going around, you'll see that young person standing out there because they just don't want to let that rating advantage go.
Yeah, the classic example was just last week as we record this, when Alex Rodriguez, his final days with the New York Yankees, where I was watching the 5 a.m. broadcasts of the TV news stations out of New York City. They all had someone outside of Yankee Stadium live at 5 in the morning. It's pitch black. You can see the spotlights from the truck and the shadows. What are you getting by broadcasting live from a street in the Bronx at 5 in the morning outside of a Yankee Stadium where even the flies aren't inside?
Well,
what do you get?
That's good, the fly balls. But I have to say, unlike the two of you, not only do I hold a PhD, but
a PhD. I never heard that.
Not only
did you know that,
Judy? Not only was I
Rex Allen has a PhD. Did you hear that?
Not only am I a full professor, but I worked in TV for a lot of years.
Oh, yes, you did.
Yes, for a lot of years.
So you explain it to us. What's
the
point?
Why do they do that?
Well, let me put it this way. They intuitively, the assignment editor or the manager, knows that something will work and that people will get a chuckle out of it and they'll do it. So they used to, for example, on the opening day of Saratoga, they used to dress me up in spats and a cane and a high hat to go to Saratoga. Well, my job was to be the bad boy, and I would say bad things about horse racing and what it did and the animalization of horses. Mm-hmm. But you knew it's all theater. That's what it is.
It's definitely theater and entertainment. And they have to know the risks of getting photobombed if they're going to stand there
of
and do a live. They know the risks and that some joker in the background is going to make the peace sign or worse.
Well,
and
that's what you worry about. You're really worried about the worst.
Yeah, it's the worst. But they understand the risks and they continue to do it. So they're aware of what's happening.
Yeah, there can be obscenities in this story from Pointer notes that, back in October, viewers watched in horror as a live broadcast from Virginia turned into a double murder. So that, in that case, the viewers got something they really didn't need to see.
And so probably that they really didn't want to see.
Didn't want to see. But I understand the need in broadcast television.
Well, it's all about ratings. That's what it is. And did you see those two people get killed on Channel X? Kind of thing, and then the word of mouth goes out and their ratings go up. And let me tell you, if you don't play the game, next, you're gone.
Just as we in the print media are challenged to find new ways of telling our stories, I think the broadcast television is also challenged. They need to find new ways of presenting their stories, rather than just standing up with a microphone in front of an empty building. That's all the time we have for, I'm afraid. Thanks to Alan Chartok and to Sushinsky for joining us this week. I'm Judy Patrick. Thanks for listening to The Media Project.
Prostitution, I don't know. Ting-a-ling-a-ling, circulation, ting-a-ling-a-ling. Advertising, get those readers, get that payoff. What a headache, what a mess. Oh, publishers are such interesting people. Let's give free cheers for freedom of the press.